Given two competing views of the world, the state will always promote the one that increases its power to extract wealth from its citizens. The choice between inflation and deflation is an easy one. Deflation empowers the citizen by allowing her modest savings to purchase more goods over time. Calling for inflation empowers the state by allowing it to print more money and by reducing the size of its enormous debts in real terms. It should be no surprise that state-funded academic institutions preach the virtues of inflation. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And just because this topic, what I wanted to read today to start off the week was, this topic has been coming up a lot again because the propaganda in defense of inflation has just exploded. And then at the exact same time, Bitcoin is under attack again, and just in general, the idea of deflationary money and how it could never work, and it needs to you need to inflate to grow the economy. Inflation is good for you. Like, it's just sickening. And I know we've covered it a couple of different times on the show, but it's been a good little while now. And I want to re-hit this piece just because, or excuse me, I want to re-hit this idea and this piece by Kyle Ward on Mises.org, which is a great resource, and I actually haven't read anything from Mises in a while, but this piece in particular, it's really short, but I think it has a really good framing, and I want to also shed some light on some ideas or on arguments that I think are really good at just destroying the inflation is necessary, inflation is good argument. So that's what we're going to do in the guy's take, and I think this piece does it really well as well. So, before we get into it, though, let's take just a second and thank our sponsors for today. First off, don't forget about Pacific Bitcoin Conference in November in LA. I'm going to be there. It is going to be a great freaking time. And you get 20% off with code GUYS. I thought I had updated that to Bitcoin Audible, but it is GUYS, G-U-Y-S. I just checked it. So if you want to come hang out with the Swan Bitcoin crew, who have been major supporters of the show, and they are the best Bitcoin onboarding experience and no noise, all signal service, you got to check it out. We're going to have a blast. Then, of course, Fold Card, the debit card that gets me sats back on everything. Bitcoin Audible gets you 20% off for them. And then lastly, CoinKite, the solution to all of your Bitcoin hardware problems. They make the OpenDime the awesome cold card wallet, the cold card MK4 in particular, and just so many great products. You got to check them out. 5% off with code Bitcoin Audible. All right, with that, let's go ahead and get into today's read. And it's titled Price Deflation and the Horrors of Falling TV Prices by Kyle Ward. For nearly a century, the state and its various allies have propagandized generations of college kids into believing that falling prices are a detriment to society. This would seem a difficult task given the absurdity of the claim, but this convenient lie has justified decades of theft from the poor to the very elites who subscribe to it. As such, it is easy to see the appeal. As Upton Sinclair said, "It is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it." For many who regularly read these pages, this article may be nothing new. The facts and concepts laid out are so obvious as to not need explaining, and yet decades of policy from the state prove otherwise. As such, this article will use the concrete example of televisions to show that falling prices do not lead to disaster. On the contrary, falling prices make us richer. It is the state, buried in debt, that fears deflation. We'll start by letting CBS News lay out the crux of the inflationist argument. Quote, if you're thinking of buying a new car and expect the price will be a lot lower 6 months from now, why not wait? Thus, falling prices shift consumption from the present to the future as consumers wait for prices to fall, and the drop in demand can further depress the economy, lead to more price decreases, more cuts in spending, and a downward spiral into a recession. Why not wait? Asks CBS News. Maybe because you need a car to get to work tomorrow, and replacing the transmission in your current car costs more than the vehicle is worth. Would people also stop eating due to falling food prices? It is difficult to imagine the average person asking such absurd questions, but to truly win the argument, we must also consider luxury goods like TVs. In a world of falling TV prices, why wouldn't we just wait forever to buy a TV? For starters, we'd never have a TV. More generally, individuals will perform economic calculation. They will compare the benefit of having the TV now against the savings gained by waiting a year. The chart below shows the U.S. price index for televisions from 1950 to 2021. In that time, the price of a TV fell by 99%. Since 2000, the drop in prices has been especially steep. Rather than causing a downward spiral of delayed spending, the number of households with a TV has continued to increase to all-time highs. Inflation propaganda does contain a kernel of truth. The best lies usually do. Consumption will certainly be higher in an inflationary regime compared to a deflationary one. This is a natural consequence of people trying to keep their wealth from being stolen. Look to any hyperinflation event to see this behavior at its most extreme. During these events, it's better to buy hard assets that can't be quantitatively eased. When facing only, quote, modest inflation, consumption is encouraged, but to a lesser degree. In no way does this relationship imply a deflationary death spiral. Instead, modest deflation would imply a modest propensity to save rather than consume. This is something we should encourage. But imagining positive feedback loops where none exist is a common theme in statist fearmongering. In a free market, prices tend to fall due to gains in productivity stemming from capital accumulation. A tractor, for example, can replace the manual labor of many men, and the resulting abundance leads to lower prices. For the past 70 years, entrepreneurs have developed capital-intensive methods to produce more and better TVs for less. This has resulted in more TVs purchased and a higher quality of life for the average person. This is in despite of thousands of doctoral theses written to the contrary over the same period. Why then the lie? Given two competing views of the world, the state will always promote the one that increases its power to extract wealth from its citizens. The choice between inflation and deflation is an easy one. Deflation empowers the citizen by allowing her modest savings to purchase more goods over time. Inflation empowers the state by allowing it to print more money and by reducing the size of its enormous debts in real terms. It should be no surprise that state-funded academic institutions preach the virtues of inflation. Neither should it surprise us that well-connected banks and corporations, those closest to the free money spigot, sing its praises on the news networks that they fund. Not only do they get first access to the new money, but inflation encourages average people to buy their stock to protect their savings. This raises the price of stocks, further enriching corporate leaders. There is no grand conspiracy pushing inflationary policies. Would that there were so that we could root it out and destroy it. Instead, it is the emergent behavior of countless state and state-adjacent actors, each seeking to maximize their power, wealth, and prestige. The only way to delay the inexorable debasement of the currency and the citizenry is to make them aware of the theft and agitated enough to fight against it. Even this can only delay the inevitable. Only complete separation between money and state will save us. The average voter may not have a degree in economics, but they do understand rising food and energy prices. We must make it clear to them that the publicly stated goal of elites and the banking cartel is precisely the higher prices they are now struggling under. TVs give us an easy example to counter the propaganda that falling prices are actually bad for us. All right. That closes out our piece by Kyle Ward on the horrors of falling TV prices. Before we get into it, let's take a moment and hit our sponsor and we'll jump back in. Swan Bitcoin. There really is not a Bitcoin onboarding experience that beats Swan Bitcoin. You set up Swan Bitcoin savings account once and it just runs. I don't even remember how long ago I set mine up, but it has been running. It has been stacking sats for me every single week and automatically sending it to my cold storage. And then you want to go next level. You want to get concierge service. You want help with your hardware wallets. You want help with your 401k. They have Swan Private that gets you the best service and access to literally the best team in the space to answer all of your questions and stay up to date with everything happening in the space. And they are throwing a major conference that is totally Bitcoin focused. It's happening in LA in November, and it is going to be wild. You gotta come to Pacific Bitcoin, the Pacific Bitcoin Conference by Swan Bitcoin. Go to guyswan.com/Pacific for more details. guyswan.com/Pacific. And also, start your Swan Bitcoin savings plan. Auto stacking during the bear market is going to pay off big time down the road. This is prime time, baby. And for the best onboarding experience out there, getting into Bitcoin, go to swanbitcoin.com/guy. There's no better place. With that, let's get back into the show. All right. So one thing I wanted to hit on this is just, it's funny how bad the logic is, or how terrible, especially when actual economists repeat this nonsense, but how terrible the understanding of the economic situation actually is, or economic thought from the context of resources rather than economic thought from some empirical data of some event in the past, without understanding the foundations of the market that led to that event, but just looking at the outcome. So where does the deflation is bad argument come from? And Kyle Ward kind of hits on it just briefly in this piece, but just that it's bad for creditors. It's bad for people who take massive amounts of debt. So it's bad for the government. The government is the biggest debtor. I think I said creditor, but I meant debtor. Someone who takes on enormous amounts of debt. It is bad for debt, and it is bad for a debt-based economy. So after we switched to the Federal Reserve and we went aggressively fractional reserve, and we went systemically fractional reserve. So the difference between fractional reserve as a single bank versus fractional reserve as a monetary system is what you end up doing is the individual banks can go bankrupt during fractional reserve because people want the money, right? But when the debt unit itself, in that context is that each bank had their own banknote. That's what they were referred to as banknotes. So Citigroup or a Citi or JP Morgan or Bank of America would have individual notes to their companies, and those notes would redeem gold at those banks. And maybe some other bank will accept those notes because, you know, maybe JP Morgan will accept Bank of America notes because they believe Bank of America has the gold. But during like a bank run when everybody was actually trying to get it redeemed for actual money, if Bank of America didn't have the gold, then everybody would stop accepting the notes. The notes would become worthless because everybody knew there wasn't any actual gold. But when the banknotes were separate and they could be valued separately, and they were just like dollar stablecoins are actually in the crypto ecosystem, is that you have Tether and you have USDC and you have the couple other dollar stablecoins, is they're specific to the institution that issues them. If Tether goes under because what is it, Bitfinex or whatever, let's say they're massively fractional reserve, they're Mt. Goxing it over there. If Tether goes under, nothing happens to USDC because they're the same, they're quote unquote backed by the same currency, but they're not the same unit. You're trusting the institution that is guaranteeing the unit. That's how banknotes used to work. But what happens, so fractional reserve is actually half sustainable simply because you can punish the people who produce fractional reserve. The fractional reserve isn't sustainable, but the economic system is, despite the existence of fractional reserve in some cases, because they go Mt. Gox, right? They die, they collapse because they're irresponsible and the systems that they've set up, the business, the financial business that they have set up is unsustainable. It is a fraud, essentially. Now, there's actually a piece by George Selgin actually believes that, has argued that a little bit of fractional reserve is inevitable and natural. And I think this is a point of contention with some Bitcoiners that I know, is that some people say that fractional reserve will happen in a banking system no matter what, and that it's not entirely a bad thing. And other people think just like full 100% reserve or nothing. And I am essentially of the latter. I am essentially of like whatever is fractional reserve, because you can't get around the fact that if I don't have any money, if I have $100 or like I have a tiny amount of money, and then I loan into existence a bunch of money for you to buy a car, and you owe that back to me. I have printed money for myself. I have made you liable for something that I never produced. Now, I can say that I would only do it to a degree that, and that's something I actually want to hit that point again, is that I didn't give you a car, you gave me a car. If I create money out of existence and give to, I loan it to you so that you can buy a car, I'm the one that owns the car. You owe it to me. You get to drive the car around, but you owe its entire value to me. Did I have the money to buy the car? No. I invented it out of thin air. Now, maybe that's only a fraction of what I have. Maybe I have $1 million and I only invented $50,000 into existence so you could buy the car. And that's potentially sustainable because not everybody's going to come get their money all at once. And so it's perfectly acceptable for me to do that. Well, I've just... What happened is I was able to counterfeit a little bit and get away with it because nobody called me on the counterfeit. Like nobody basically called due all of my debts at once. But I don't think that makes it not immoral to counterfeit. I think it's the same thing. But anyway, back to my original point, is that when this became systemic to the monetary system and you had more debt flooded into the system and we slowly became a debt-based economy. In that scenario, deflation is bad because it increases the value that you owe against what you can produce. That's why a debt-based economy is a bad idea. Now, that doesn't mean that an economy wouldn't have debt, which is amazing how many times I get that argument in response to, you think there shouldn't be debt? No, that's stupid, but that doesn't mean that that the only other alternative is a debt-based economy. Debt is a natural thing that should obtain a market price based on the capital that is available to hand out to people. Capital that is dormant, that is not needed right at this moment, and is extra. Surplus should be loaned, but you should not re-loan and re-leverage debt for things that you have yet to produce over and over again in this constant stream of owing the last thing that you owed, but using the value that someone is going to eventually produce to create more money for the next person to owe. We are in this perpetual debt to pay off debt cycle, and it is a disaster. It's unsustainable. And if you have deflation in that environment, if you don't have constant growth, it collapses. You can't just be at that whole system. If you create debt as a systemic monetary good that is produced at the base layer, and that the debt unit, the unit of issued debt, is not separate from the monetary unit. Think about it. In the context of banknotes, when banknotes were specific to the bank, the debt of the bank was not the money. The money was the gold that was backing it. So the debt note could be valued independently The trust mechanism, the failure of the trust mechanism, could be valued independently of the gold. The gold was the trustless peg. But now, our money is dead. So it can't be separated from the economy. The failure of the credit market is the failure of the money. They aren't separate anymore. They can't be priced individually. The credit can't fall apart while everybody runs to the money because there's no difference. The fractional reserve is systemic. It is the money. When a bank issues a loan for you to buy a house into existence, there's no way to tell the difference between the fact that that is issued money versus quote-unquote real money. There's no difference. They're the same thing. Therefore, since there is always more debt in the system and you always owe the amount that exists plus interest, you can't not grow. It's impossible for you to have static or negative growth without an economic disaster, because then you get increasingly further and further behind. You can't be at zero. You can't be at zero. In a surplus economy, in a savings economy, it's fine to just not grow 1 year. You just sort out your crap, you cut the fat, you be a little bit more frugal, and you get back to work. You have surplus to dig into. It is only the fiat economy, it is only the systemic debt economy that requires you to consume aggressively and consume more every single year, and more debt and more consumption until it basically runs itself into the ground, or basically rocket ships itself into the side of a mountain and we all blow up and die. So that's where it came from. Deflation is terrible if everything is based on debt. And deflation happens in that environment because you've issued a whole bunch of credit and then turns out you can't pay it all off. And when you can't pay off the loan to me, I issued, you know, $50,000 so that you could get a car. When we find out that you can't pay off that car, you can't, you know, pay me back that $50,000, and that loan is defaulted on, that $50,000 disappears. The deflation isn't the value of the money increasing. The deflation is the deletion of money in the economy because the money is debt. If people start defaulting, it means that it's like if Satoshi was actually part of the economy and had 1 million coins, and then one day we just deleted all of his coins. Yes, that would be aggressively deflationary, but not because we have more production, not because we have more capital, but because somebody deleted a ton of the money. Well, because our debt is, the newly issued debt is indistinguishable from actual money in our economy, that can happen. We can have awful recessionary, stagflation, deflationary events because we've conflated two things that should be separate. Credit and money. Credit is a currency tool that requires trust. Money is explicitly the good in society that is valued because it doesn't have trust, because it's the least amount of trust. So that's where I think a lot of the foundational problems of our monetary system come from. It's based in that idea and then what that idea enables. Going back to Kyle Ward's piece here, he says, there's a quote from CBS explaining, says, if you're thinking, so this is why deflation is bad, by the way, throw out the debt deflation, because that's not what we're talking about. Deflation in the natural economy is from additional capital. It is from growth in productivity, the number of goods, the number of houses on the market. Like if there are, 100 people trying to buy 100 houses and there's 90 houses, well, then prices will go up. If you build 20 more houses and now there's 110 houses, well, then prices go down. Your dollar gets worth more because there is a greater supply of goods on the market. And now the 100 best houses of the 110 get sold, and the other 10 either get fire sold off for somebody who can build them better or improve them, et cetera, et cetera. You actually have, things change hands for good reasons rather than just because it's the only goods available. Real deflation is because of growth. Real deflation is because of production and more capital than more capital against the same amount of goods. So here's the CBS quote. If you're thinking of buying a new car and expect the price will be a lot lower 6 months from now, why not wait? Thus, falling prices shift consumption from the present to the future as consumers wait for prices to fall, and the drop in demand can further depress the economy, lead to more price decreases, more cuts in spending, and a downward spiral into a recession. In this one sentence, this is one just really long sentence, yes. In this one sentence, it contradicts itself. Understand, if you go into a downward spiral and the economy is depressed and you move into a recession, there is no more deflation in the money. That only happens if you've indebted yourself up to your eyeballs and you couldn't afford any of it and it was unsustainable and now everybody has to default. Well, that's your fault because you probably manipulated the price of debt. You probably inflated the currency and issued new debt against money that didn't exist or conflated money and credit, and you've destroyed the economy. You've misallocated massive amounts of resources. Now, yes, you do need to have a correction, but in natural deflation, just because prices decrease over time does not mean that people won't consume. Consumption is the one thing you don't have to incentivize. Everybody needs to consume. The whole reason to have money is because look at all the stuff that I can consume in the future. I mean, seriously, have you seen what happens to a store on Christmas or when Sony comes out with a new product? You don't need to incentivize consumption. People must consume in order to survive. You can't get rich by hoarding billions of dollars and never spending it on anything. I have never once seen a homeless person who has $1 billion because they forever waited to buy a house for cheaper or a TV for cheaper or a car for cheaper. That is not a reality. It's so stupid to think that that's how the economy works, aside from the fact that as soon as the economy is not growing, there is no deflation, because that is what deflation means. Deflation in a fixed money supply in a sound economy that isn't indebted up to their eyeballs is simply a result of growth. When it grows, there is deflation. It's not a cause, it's an effect. So there's two ways, I think, to reframe this fallacy that I think are, well, first one is that natural deflation cannot happen in a downward spiral and in a recession because deflation is the consequence of growth. So that's the first one. But then the other argument that they say is that you don't want people to hoard money, that they need to put that money to use because if they hoard money, well, then people won't have money. And which is so stupid because money's just an allocation of resources. The reason the value of the money goes up is because the same unit of money now purchases more goods, which means it's true of literally everybody who has money. It's spread out across the entire society. So deflation in a fixed money supply is literally just sharing the society surplus with everybody who participated in that surplus across society. It's society sharing the spoils of being productive. But the argument goes that if people hoard money, well, then it won't be used for investment. It won't be used for, it should be put in stocks. No, it shouldn't be risked by people who have no idea how to risk their money on something intelligently. You should not make stupid people or people who have no time to learn how to invest because they specialized in being a plumber. Like, why should they have to now be an investor too just to keep their money? But you say that they're going to hoard money. Well, why are they going to hoard money? Because they want to maintain their value? Okay, that's interesting. So this is a behavior of people. They want to hold something that maintains its value. And you were saying that if you destroy the value of that thing that is maintaining the value, well, then they have to invest in something else. Well, what do they do? What do they do? They buy commodities, they buy real estate, they buy stock. They buy things that people actually need to produce and to live inside of, but not for their use, not for their investment purposes, simply to store wealth, to park wealth. So they're saying that a non-consumable good that is whose entire purpose is to store money should not be used to store money, and instead we should use houses and commodities, things that people need. We should take these things off of the market and hoard them instead. They're going to just hoard something. Are you saying that people are simply, they simply become aliens. They become different people when you destroy the value of the money. Instead, what you're actually doing is you're getting people to park wealth and create monetary premiums for stuff that people actually need. For food, for water, for shelter, for copper, for gold, for silver. For real things needed to produce real goods for people in the economy, you pointlessly drive up these prices and make these things hard to obtain for the people who don't have any savings, who are living hand to mouth. You make life harder for them. And then what do you need? You need the government to come in and issue everybody debt and manipulate the price of debt lower so that they can all become permanent slaves but still live in houses. What we should do is make those things more affordable by having people who don't need them not buy them. Houses should not have monetary premiums. That is purely a consequence of crappy money. And there's another quote in here from Kyle there's actually a bunch of good little things in here. I don't have time to go over all of it, unfortunately. But one of them says, neither should it surprise us that well-connected banks and corporations, those closest to the free money spigot, sing its praises on the news networks that they fund. Not only do they get first access to the new money, but inflation encourages average people to buy their stock to protect their savings. This raises the price of stocks, further enriching corporate leaders. This is how everything becomes financialized. I think it's since the 1980s that the financial system is like twice the size. I could be wrong on the time period, but the financial industry is twice the amount of GDP as it was, which means that twice the amount of money is purely in financial assets, in stocks and bonds, as in, you know, the S&P and in NASDAQ and all these companies. They never needed to be there. What happened is the politicians and the corporate elite just created a fake incentive to subsidize their own industry. And this is something I tweeted earlier today, actually, is, you know, you have that normal, that framing, that ridiculous framing of, quote, you know, inflation encourages people to invest money instead of hoard money, because hoarding money is bad. And this ridiculous propaganda from the explicit part of the economy, the elitist, the academia, everybody who benefits, everybody who is basically part of an industry that survives entirely off government debt and inflation. So, of course, what are they going to see? They can't see anything other than the fact that inflation is crucial to their economy. And who are they? They're the most important people in the world. They're the wealthy people. They're the academic elite. They're the politicians. Everybody loves it. They're the center of everything. Why? Because trillions of dollars is funded through, is funneled through their corporate monster every single year. That's why they're the center of everything, because they're confiscating everybody's resources. They have a counterfeit machine. Of course, everybody desperately wants to cling to their coattails and get whatever change that they drop. So understanding the idea that inflation encourages people to invest instead of hoard? No. What, turn that around. Understand what it is from the context of the people who are telling it to you. The real way to frame that is that if they bleed the value of everyone's savings, it creates an artificial incentive for the average person to put all of their money, put their retirement, put everything that they intend to save into the stock market, to pump up their corporate bags in a way that they never would, to take risks that get them the money, that let them distribute the money. This is how you create a casino of the financial system, of gross speculation, of utter idiots misallocating resources everywhere, because everybody's just passive investing. Nobody has any idea. Most of the money goes in not caring where it goes. They just put it in the thing that's big for the sake of it being big. The average person doesn't have time to be an investor or to understand how to analyze a business for, you know, its real prospects. So what do? They just put it in these giant centralized buckets run by these corporate monsters that just put the money wherever the heck they want. They got the Black Rocks and the Vanguards of the world that just take all the voting power, and then they own everything with our money. All because all money that shouldn't be there, because the actual money doesn't do the one job it's supposed to do. And I love that Kyle actually points out that this, it doesn't require a conspiracy theory. It's just incentives. Just incentives do everything that's needed to make that work. Now, maybe there is some portion of conspiracies, you know, there are bankers who want to keep this afloat. The central bankers that I think do know what is going on. I think there's a lot of very, very immoral and corrupt people who are at the heart of so much of this, but it doesn't need to be. It would happen exactly the same way simply because it exists, and that's how the incentives line up. It will create the very people and the very mindset that keeps it alive because it's insanely profitable to have a counterfeit machine and excuse yourself as the only one that should be able to run the printer. And I loved, I think, just sum it up with this quote. This was my favorite quote. It says, "There is no grand conspiracy pushing inflationary policies. Would that there were, so that we could root it out and destroy it. Instead, it is the emergent behavior of countless state and state-adjacent actors, each seeking to maximize their power, wealth, and prestige. The only way to delay the inexorable debasement of the currency and the citizenry is to make them aware of the theft and agitated enough to fight against it. Even this can only delay the inevitable. Only complete separation between money and state will save us." End quote. That is, when I was reading through this, that was the line that was like, yeah, I'm going to read this on the show. And Kyle may not realize this, and I think if he did realize this, he would have mentioned it in the article, but Bitcoin is that way. Just like Hayek said, is that the only way to actually do this is to separate money and state. The only way that we will ever have a good money again is to realign the incentives and let them drive themselves. The incentive, we must correct the incentive. And because of that, we must create something that the government cannot screw the incentive up. Just like Hayek said, we cannot take it violently out of the hands of the government, but in some sly roundabout way, we must introduce something that they cannot stop. And that is Bitcoin. That is why we are here, and that is why I really like this article. And I thought this was a good one to cover on the show. So thank you guys for listening. I hope you enjoyed this one. Check out Mises.org and Kyle Ward's other work if you have not. Highly, highly recommended. They are a wonderful resource. And a thank you to CoinKite, and the cold card, and so much, all the hardware stuff and everything they've done for Bitcoin. To Swan Bitcoin for the Pacific Bitcoin Conference, because I am freaking stoked about that. Don't forget discount codes. But also for just being the best onboarding experience out there. I've been using Swan since Swan came about. I love that company. And then lastly, Fold. The Fold debit card. I've been stacking sats like crazy with stuff. With the price down where it is, man, I get a lot of sats back. Check them all out. Links and discount codes in the show notes. And I will catch you guys on the next episode, where we will learn more about Bitcoin, we will read about Bitcoin, and we will cover all the fascinating topics that make this thing what it is. We are here to separate money and state. And I am Guy Swan. And until next time, take it easy, guys. You have been listening to Bitcoin Audible, a 111 production.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.